Welcome to the Digital Show Podcast. Every week, your hosts Kevin Werbach, Kartik Osanagar, and Lauren Feldman will talk with business leaders, entrepreneurs, policymakers, and experts about how technology is changing our world. From software to the internet to mobile, we explore the digital issues facing you and your organization. Here's this week's host.
I'm your host this week, Kevin Werbach. I'm a professor of legal studies and business ethics here at Wharton. So without further ado, let me bring out my first guest. Charlene Lee, as I said, is an analyst. She's the founder and CEO of the Altimeter Group. She has written or co-written best-selling books, including Open Leadership and Groundswell. And as I said, her new book, just out, or maybe out in a couple of days, she'll tell us, is called The Engaged Leader, and it's being published by our own Wharton Digital Press. Charlene, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
So you were, I think, pretty far ahead of the curve in seeing the importance of social media, not just as something for kids and kind of private interactions, but as an important business tool. How have things evolved, and why is it particularly valuable for leaders?
Well, it's definitely evolved because I think no longer are companies asking, is this a fad? This is a reality. And more than anything else, because customers are using it to connect with each other, and they want to use it to connect with companies too. So the analogy that I like to use is like if the phone was ringing, you would automatically, of course, pick it up because you know a customer's on the other end. And it's the same thing with these new digital and social channels. Your customers are there, so you have to be there too. Now, the problem is that the companies may be there, but the leaders themselves are still scratching their heads about how do they personally do this. And that was the reason why I wrote the book, because I kept coming across all these executives who kind of secretly would pull me aside and go, I'm telling my entire organization to get digital, but I don't know how to do it myself. So I wrote this book for them.
What do you think they're afraid of?
They don't know what it means to be a leader in this space, because leadership has always meant that I have a title, and there's a certain approach to being a leader. I have to maintain my distance. And more than anything else, I have to be perfect. I have to be infallible. And I don't think anybody's ever asked a leader to do that. And in many ways, this digital space, because it is a two-way conversation, how do you exert leadership? How do you exert power and influence and get things done and yet still have transparency, authenticity, be human? It's a new way of leading that most leaders have never been trained in how to do this.
Yeah, it's interesting. So it sounds like what you're saying is this is not just something leaders need to do, just put it on your checklist, but it changes the nature of leadership.
It does. And in many ways, what the internet and digital and these social channels have done is they've stripped and disconnected your title from your actual leadership inside of these channels. Because think of it this way, a leader has followers, and now anybody can have followers on Twitter or on Facebook or on LinkedIn. And you could be a leader in real life and have no followers, have no credibility. And that in itself is daunting. So what does it mean to be a leader in the digital era where your credibility and the trust in the relationships you developed has everything to do with what you do in these digital channels and less to do with what happens in real life?
But I'm assuming, you know, some leaders would say, sure, that's true, but you know, the company is what projects to the outside. Sure, internally dealing with employees, I need to be there, you know, personally and projecting who I am and what my values are. But I can do that in person, over email, in the company, and so forth. Why do I need to be out there on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, whatever?
Well, let's be very clear. I'm not saying they need to be out on in the public space.
Okay.
They need to have thought through it and made a strategic choice of where they will engage, where they will be active, where they will listen and share and engage. Now, I have no problem with an executive saying, I've taken a look at it. It's not on my priority list because I have these other things I have to do. That is a strategic choice because strategy is what you will do and just as importantly, what you won't do. And my favorite example of that is Ginni Rometty. She's the CEO of IBM, mm-hmm. Very visible, very tech, women in the space. So she has a lot to say. And she has a Twitter account that she's never used. It's established. She listens to it. She and her team listen to the conversations that revolve around her presence on Twitter. but she herself does not use it because her activity is very strongly, again, internally, but she's extremely active internally, using all of the channels, sharing content, listening, responding to people, engaging with people. And when I ask people, you know, who do you think is one of the most transformational leaders out there among your clients, IBM people would say, oh, you've got to look at our CEO. And I heard this over and over again. I go, but she's not visible at all externally, but incredibly active internally. So that's a strategic choice. And I think she's one of my role models for an engaged leader because she has made a choice. She's made a strategic plan of what she will do and won't do to engage in these digital channels.
Charlene Lee, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
The new book is The Engaged Leader from Wharton Digital Press. Great to have you, Charlene. Delighted to have my next guest on, Erin Knight, who is the executive director of the Badge Alliance. She's going to talk to us about what's happening in the world of digital badges, how things are developing, and what digital badges might mean for new forms of credentialing. The Badge Alliance is a network of organizations that's building an ecosystem around digital badges. As I think Erin will talk about, it grew out of some work that she also spearheaded at the Mozilla Foundation, which is the company that makes the Mozilla browser and various other initiatives. So, Erin, welcome. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's start out for context, as we have listeners with all different levels of familiarity with these sorts of things. What is a digital badge?
Definitely start there. So a digital badge is a record or recognition of learning, skill, interest, affiliation. It's basically just a digital way to actually capture some experience or learning that actually has the information included, like criteria, evidence, who issued it, et cetera. So it becomes a verifiable way to demonstrate something that you've learned.
So it shows up as an image, a file that looks like a physical badge, but there's something more going on behind it.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, the Boy and Girl Scouts are the first thing that come to mind when people think badge. And there's actually a lot from that we would want to build from in this kind of reimagining credentialing space. In scouting, those badges were about explicit skills. They often unlocked access to the next thing that you needed to do on a path to mastery, and they had a huge reputational component. So we want to build on top of that, but once we move into the digital world, again, what that gives us the opportunity to do is make these be information-rich and verifiable. So it's less about that sort of cutesy image or the, kind of the stitched part on the front, if you will. It's about that metadata or information that every badge is carrying with it.
And why do we need these?
So, if you stop and look at the sort of learning landscape that we have today, there are more learning opportunities than ever across the web. There's more recognition or at least appreciation of interest-based learning, informal learning, et cetera. So there's more opportunities than ever for people to really learn and to explore things and to even go after different kind of career pathways. But most of that learning still doesn't count. Most of it's not captured in any way or recognized in any way that you can communicate it in a verifiable way to an employer or a stakeholder. So ultimately, it's about making sure that all of your learning and experiences count. And then on top of that, it's really making sure that learning isn't in isolation as well, so that you're learning from one context or one experience is actually connected or could be connected to other possibilities or pathways for you.
Great. Terrific. Thanks so much for being on the show. Erin Knight from the Badge Alliance.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm delighted to have with us on the phone Bruce Schneier, who's one of the best-known security technologists in the world, author of, I believe, 12 books on digital privacy and security. The latest one is called Data and Goliath. And so, Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us on The Digital Show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So what's going on out there? What should we think about information security and privacy today?
Well, what's going on out there is that data is being collected. I mean, sort of broadly speaking, every time we interact with a computer, data about that interaction is generated. And it's our computers, our phones, retail terminals, cameras, anything we do involves a computer these days. And those computers produce data, and that data is now being increasingly stored, searched, and used. So in a sense, we're wandering around a world of all of these data sensors that are sensing us and collecting information about us as we go about our lives.
And, I mean, the subtitle of your book talks about this as a hidden battle to capture data. Why is it hidden?
Well, it's hidden because it's not obvious to us. You know, it's not like there are 50 people peering over our shoulder as we wander around the internet, but there might be 50 companies with tracking devices in our browsers doing that. It's not like Facebook reminds us, hey, we're collecting all of your data and everything you say. It's just that they do it. Or, you know, we don't pick up our phone in the morning and say, I'm going to carry my tracking device with me. Yet it is a tracking device because otherwise it can't ring wherever you are. So a lot of this surveillance is hidden. It's not something we notice because it happens on the computers, not in real life.
Is it something we just have to take for granted and get used to in this connected digital world?
Well, hopefully not, because it's very invasive. Your phone actually is a great example. Because it knows where you are at all times, it has you under constant surveillance. It knows where you live, it knows where you work, it knows when you go to sleep, when you wake up in the morning, it knows who you sleep with. You know, and it knows all of these things. Yeah, I don't think we have to take it for granted. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that this data will be collected and analyzed. I mean, last year, Uber collected its data and figured out taken taxi rides to have sex. And they published aggregate data on, you know, what the good cities for that was and what the good neighborhoods, but they had the individual data. I mean, it's not necessarily true that they keep that data and they do that analysis.
So what should we do if we're concerned about that? That things like that, when people hear about them, they freak them out. But obviously, despite all these revelations, people still go back to using these tools.
Well, you can't tell them not to. I mean, if I give advice on the order of don't carry a cell phone, don't have an email address, I mean, that's not viable advice. You can't live as a fully functioning human being in society without these tools. I mean, really, a lot of these problems are political, and it's going to be legislative changes. It's not going to be this magic tech you carry that'll stop this surveillance, because a lot of it happens by third parties. It's going to be recognizing that privacy is a value and encoding it into our laws. I mean, that might take 10 to 20 years, but that is going to be the solution.
Are you optimistic that's actually going to happen?
You know, I'm short-term pessimistic, long-term optimistic.
Huh.
I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. I don't think it's going to happen in the next administration. But I do think we are going to solve this, that fundamentally over the decades, we become a better society, become more moral, more inclusive, more fair. And this isn't going to be the death of privacy. Privacy is just too important to human value. So while it may take time to figure out, I do think we will figure it out. I'm not sure it'll be my generation, it might be the next generation, but we will figure it out.
And I assume it's fair to say it's not a technology so much. I mean, you're a very distinguished cryptographer. This is not just a matter of we need another algorithm to keep things secure. You're talking about values and what's important to society.
Right, because it's not the math. I mean, there are math tools, and they protect you around the edges. I mean, your email is probably stored by Google. Your photographs are on some other site. You're on Facebook. You have a cell phone. All of the data produced by these devices can't be encrypted because they're used by the system. Right? Your credit card data on Home Depot and your health data on Anthem. Right? These third parties have the data, and it's less hackers getting at it and more what's being done legitimately, what's being done legally. You know, what corporations have access, how they can buy and sell it, how when government gets access. Right, depending on the country we live in, the rules are going to be very different there. So while cryptography and computer security, all these things help, they are just tools. We're living in a really weird world where the technology can subvert the law and the law can subvert the technology. So you actually need both to make it work.
Hmm. Great. Bruce Schneier, thanks so much for joining us on The Digital Show.
Thank you.
Been terrific to have you. The book, again, is Data and Goliath. So we're going to turn now to some of the practical implications of some of these issues. I'm joined now in the studio by Lisa Casey Spaniel, who's a partner at the law firm of Blank Rome. Her practice includes intellectual property, software and technology licensing, outsourcing, data aggregation and privacy issues. And she's right here in Philadelphia. So, Lisa, great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Kevin. Great to be here.
So let me pick up with you where I ended with Bruce. He talked about the fact that, well, maybe companies shouldn't collect all the data that they can. So you actually work with companies advising them as their lawyer. Is that consistent with what you tell them?
Well, he's right. The data is a liability, and you have to keep that in mind. Of course, there will be laws and sectors that have data retention policies, and we do have to keep our eye on whether there are issues as to whether you're destroying evidence. So, you know, if there is a data breach, you need to consider how quickly you destroy the facts of that matter, because you do need to preserve evidence. And so it is, I think, a two-sided coin where you have to consider both factors and weigh the best way to handle it.
Do you think that most companies today take information security and privacy issues seriously enough?
I think it actually absolutely depends on which company you are. And the larger companies out there are taking it extremely seriously, almost too seriously, to the point where I think we see a lot of demands on vendors and business partners that can be unrealistic and unattainable.
Let me just let those of you know, if you are just tuning in, you're listening to The Digital Show on SiriusXM Business Radio. I'm Kevin Werbeck, and we're talking right now data security with Lisa Casey Spaniel of Blank Rome. Give us a call. We'd love to hear your thoughts about information collection and privacy hacking and all these issues. 1-844-WHARTON. That's 1-844-942-7866. So do companies tend to think, in your experience, that just the more the information they collect, the better?
Many do, I think. And, you know, we all are living in the data aggregation age and the big data age, and we certainly have a flood of companies that are using that information in, you know, good, bad, and ugly ways. And so it's all, I think, a matter of perspective on how you feel about that. But it certainly is the trend, as Bruce very much points out. And so it is an issue that I think every company has to deal with. And I think there are companies that really don't think that they process information, and they absolutely do, and they need to be more concerned about data security. He mentioned Target, and, you know, the Target breach was through a cooling company. So, you know, it's unlikely that company really imagined that they would have the type of personal information exposure that ultimately they did in the Target circumstance.
What are some of the legal issues or some of the requirements that companies may need to think about in this area?
Sure. We'll talk about it from the U.S. perspective. The U.S. is a sectoral approach. Outside the United States and Canada and the European Union and other places, there are blanket data protection laws. But here in the U.S., we just have a sectoral approach, at least for now. The White House did recently announce a data privacy bill that would be universal, that has met with both appreciation and skepticism. So we will see where that goes. But for now, there are laws that specifically protect healthcare information, banking information, children's information. So, you know, those are the major areas where you know you're within a regulatory scheme.
Great. Lisa Casey Spaniel, thanks so much for joining us on The Digital Show. It's been great to have you.
Always good to see you, Kevin. Thanks.
You too. And one of the people I met way back then in the early days now of the internet in the 1990s was Nova Spivak, who was one of the founders of one of the first dot-com IPOs, and ever since has been a pioneer in fields like search and AI and big data and semantic web and all kinds of other fun stuff at a string of different companies and as an investor. And so his current company is called Bottlenose, and I thought it'd be great to talk to Nova about what he's seeing out there and what's potential now, what the potential is today of using analytic techniques for trend analysis. So Nova, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Kevin, thank you. Great to talk to you again.
You as well. So jumping off of what I just said, catch us up. I mean, to someone who's been looking at these kinds of technologies, analytics, big data, machine learning, and so forth, for now a fairly long time, what are the kinds of things that we can do today that we couldn't do 10 or even 5 years ago?
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, because of the continuing advance of Moore's Law, the cost of computing and the cost of storage continue to fall, and that has changed the economics of cloud computing pretty dramatically over the last decade. It's now possible to leverage large numbers of servers, of computers in the cloud, pretty cheaply to do brute force computations, which used to be too expensive to consider. And a whole host of companies have grown up to provide these cloud computing services, not the least of which is Amazon. And this has really changed the game for a lot of companies, a lot of startups, and even big enterprises that are trying to compute on big data. So first of all, one big change is really the growth of cheap distributed cloud computing.
Mm-hmm.
Another big change is the growth of the data itself. So in the last decade or so, there's been a huge spike in one particular class of data, which we might call stream data. And this is a subset of big data, big data being the set of all data that's really large data, things like gigabytes, petabytes, exabytes of data. That's big data. Stream data is a subset of that and is data that is time-stamped or series of messages over time. And one example of that is social media, where we have fire hoses coming out of Twitter and Facebook and Tumblr, and they're producing quite a lot of data every day. So in the last decade or so, this has just been exponentially growing, and the volumes of data that we deal with today are much greater. So they require a much greater computing power.
Mm-hmm.
So fortunately, the growth of cloud computing and the continuing better economics of cloud computing help in facing that challenge of dealing with these volumes of stream data.
What's significant? I'm sorry, let me just stop you there. I mean, so what's significant about the stream data? Why is that important to carve out as a separate category?
Well, if you look at the big data world, there's one technology that's very popular. It's an ecosystem around something called Hadoop. And Hadoop is very good for doing very large computations, but it's not particularly fast. So if you're dealing with static data sets, you know, a year of data that's not changing, then doing a large Hadoop computation in one of many different platforms that can do that, that's feasible. And if you don't need the answer right away, if you can wait hours, days, even weeks to get the answer, fine, Hadoop is great. But when you're dealing with changing data, a very high volume changing data, and if you need an answer now, Hadoop just isn't the right match for that. If you ran a computation in Hadoop, by the time it completed, there'd be so much new data that had happened since then that the computation would no longer really be current. So the problem is, if you're using Hadoop and the classic big data approach to real-time or streaming data, it just doesn't map well to the problem. You need new technologies to actually handle stream data in near real-time or real-time, and to get answers faster on changing data. And so that is a new frontier, this growth of stream data. In fact, Gartner has has alluded to this as one of the fastest growing classes of data in the enterprise, and also a form of data that most enterprises are not yet really equipped to capture and deal with. Now, when we talk about stream data, there are many, many examples. It's not just social fire hoses. There are all kinds of different streams of data. For example, IT systems and applications, firewalls, are putting out log files in a series of log events. These are stream data events.
Nova Spivak from Bottlenose, thanks so much for coming on the show. I'd love to have you back sometime to chat more about this incredible data-centric world that we live in.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This has been the Digital Show Podcast. To find out more about the Digital Show, visit our site at digitalshow111.com or follow us on Twitter @digitalshow111. We'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening.